I am Jennifer Walser, and you are listening to CKMS 102.7 FM Radio Waterloo.
Hi, this is Paul Jolly, and I must tell you, I've been to Mississippi, and I've been to Nicollet. I've been to the Earth Bay on the West Coast, and I've been down to Trinity Bay in Newfoundland. And I love community radio, because that's how you find out what's happening, man.
I'm Jody Swinnell. Welcome to episode 4 of Reader's Delight. We're here to bring together writers and readers of the region, plus promote our vibrant literary community. It's Sunday, April 21st, and we're live on CKMS 102.7 FM Radio Waterloo. Reader's Delight is brought to you by the KW Writers Alliance. We have three authors in the studio today. Prepare to be captivated as they read excerpts of their story. It's my privilege to introduce our first reader, Jeff Martin. Jeff is a creative nonfiction writer who is finishing a book about home, belonging, and land history in this region. He is also a co-founder of the Creek Collective, which makes art alongside and in response to Schneider Creek here in Kitchener. Hi, Jeff.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
No problem. It's my pleasure. What does the Creek Collective have planned for this spring?
Sure. So we're a group of artists who have come together around a shared interest in the creek and in making art in response to it. And so this started out last summer, and we have a whole set of events lined up for the end of May and early June. So there'll be an exhibit at InterArts Matrix at Globe Studios that will open at the end of May. From two artists who were here last summer making art in Sandhills Park.
Nice.
So there's going to be an artist talk at Schneider House on Thursday, May 30th, and I'm creating an audio walk alongside Schneider Creek, which we'll talk about.
Nice.
And I'm reading from here. But there's as part of Open Ears Festival, one of the artists is Deborah Carruthers, and she's making a graphic score in response to the creek. So she's been collecting scientific data. Her background is in science, and then she moved into art, and then she's a composer now. But she's an artist, like a visual arts composer.
That's
so
amazing.
The Ice Ensemble from Laurier is going to perform her painting at the Schneider House Amphitheater June 1st and 2nd in the morning. So there's projection work. We have an aerial performance artist who's going to perform alongside the creek.
Wow.
A whole set of things, including a community arts mural workshop. So we're inviting the community to the creek to paint a mural about
it. That's great. How many people are involved in this project?
There's 9 of us on the collective, but there's a whole host of people sort of around us and are interested in the work. And
for sure.
We're not closing ranks, so all are welcome.
That's a good way to put it. Nice. Can you describe what the writing process is like for you?
Sure. I tend to be a fairly heavily place-based writer. I think about place a lot. I think about it as I move through a place, and then I'm actively journaling about those experiences. So the Schneider Creek essay is 2 years in the making because I moved back here. I grew up in the region, but I moved to Kitchener 3 years ago and immediately set out being interested in Schneider Creek as this kind of woe-begotten stormwater ditch that runs through the back of my neighborhood. So I started walking its banks. I have a toddler, and we walk there all the time to see the water.
Nice.
I was just interested in it because I was a resident of the place. But part of it has to do with my interest in environmentalism and in place-based thinking and different ways of thinking about our world. So I really like ideas around watershed thinking. So instead of limiting the way you think about the politics and your social relations in mm-hmm. terms of political boundaries, like city boundaries and township boundaries, if we're talking about this region, to think in terms of the watershed means that you think more expansively about how places are connected to each other underground through aquifers, how our creeks flow into our rivers, how our rivers flow into our lakes, and then the ocean, so that you end up you can kind of you can really think globally, you know, as the tagline goes, thinking globally, acting locally.
That's really interesting. So. I tend to just rush through an environment.
Well, of course.
And
yeah.
I'm so in my head, I don't even actually appreciate it. Mm. I have to slow down sometimes, and then I'll, because I grew up in a smaller town, so I'm aware of creeks and all the life and everything that's there. So it's kind of neat when I've moved to the city. I think everything's so bustly.
Well, I think one of the things, when you live in a small town, you get the experience of walking that town or biking that town, and which teaches you about the topography. You're aware of hills and valleys because you can feel it in your legs when you're biking. And in a city, our cars are so powerful, we don't really notice inclines. And it's easy to not notice that you're actually on a slightly downward slope, and that water that lands on this parking lot would go down this drain and flow to that main pipe and end up in Schneider Creek.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah.
Wow. I never actually thought of that. I never met anybody who paid so much attention. I'm really excited to hear your work.
Great, thank you.
What was I going to ask? What is an early experience where you learned that language had power?
Oh, boy. That's a great question. It's been such a part of my life. I was such an avid reader growing up, and so I've always felt that power of other people's writing to convey feeling and expression about the world, like especially in fantasy. I grew up in that, reading the Chronicles of Narnia and living in that world.
Of course.
For me, I wrote a poem in grade 9 that came to me fast and was tangential to the assignment, but it just felt like I wanted to create something to augment a group presentation. And it ended up conveying actually it was water related. It was a waterfall. I've never thought of that. But the prompt was something about like the birth of song, or like the origin of our stories. And it was very like mythic. It was grade 9 English.
Nice.
But the poem felt really powerful, and the teacher responded really well to it and gave me critique in a really meaningful, almost adult way. And I felt like, wow, this thing has power.
That set you off, huh?
It set me off. I've long wanted to be a writer, and it took me a while to get there.
I understand that. I don't have the same story, but I'm a bit older, so it took me a while to even believe in myself.
That's right. Yeah. It took Julia Cameron's The Artist's Way. Do you know that 12-step recovery program? It's like an artist recovery program.
Oh, I have to look into that.
Yeah. I'm an evangelist for Julia Cameron.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense. So I understand you will be reading from a new essay called Surface Tension.
That's right.
You want to go ahead and tell us about it?
Yeah.
And begin?
So as a component of the Creek Collective's artwork, different kinds of work that's happening at the end of May and early June, I'm putting together this audio walk that would have 7 audio stations where you, starting from Willow River Park, Victoria Park Lake, and then have 7 stations on the way down to Sterling Avenue and Cortland Avenue intersection. So it's like it's about a kilometer, 1.2 kilometers. So it'd be like a 16-minute direct walk. But I'm asking people to spend 35 to 45 minutes and at 7 spots stopping to listen to 3 to 5 minute excerpts of this essay. And alongside, it'll be mixed with birdsong and possibly the musicians' recordings from the amphitheater performance that's happening at the end of at early June. So I'm going to read today from two stations, basically.
Okay.
So I'm going to read the 2nd station and the 4th station. The 1st station is at David Street. And what's really interesting, are you familiar with the park and Schneider House?
Yes, a little bit.
Sure. So David Street and Queen Street run parallel, and Schneider House is between those two streets. And there's this interesting wooded path right beside Schneider House, with a small little ditch beside the path. But in fact, that's the start of Schneider Creek, and the Schneider Creek is running underground there. It's tunneled all the way under David Street, and then under beside Schneider House, under Queen Street. Then there's a park on the other side of the street, and then it comes out to daylight, and that begins its concrete channelization all the way south to Rockaway Golf Course.
Okay.
So the 1st station is right at that, on top of that tunnel, and then the 2nd is right in front of Schneider House, and that's where I'll start.
Excellent.
Okay. So station number 2, Inland City, Queen Street at Schneider House National Historical Site. The strange thing about both Kitchener and Waterloo is that they're not built alongside major lakes or rivers, like Cambridge nearby, or like most other urban areas around the world. We're a two-pair inland city here in the middle of the province of Ontario. We're strangely landlocked, despite being wedged by three Great Lakes. In the early 1800s, when Joseph Schneider and Barbara Eby built their house and barn and water-powered sawmill alongside the creek that came to bear his last name, this land was not primeval wilderness. That's a pioneer myth that distorts the truth. In fact, this was and is a landscape long tended by the Haudenosaunee and Anishinaabe, groomed trails, fish and game management, regular grassland and underbrush burning. This was shared hunting ground, per the terms of the Dish with One Spoon Agreement. Mennonite historian E. Reginald Good claims that what became the site of Berlin was especially important to the Haudenosaunee because it was centered at the hub of a vast trail network, linking Lake Huron to the west and Georgian Bay to the north, with the Grand River all the way south to Lakes Erie and Ontario. Reginald Good works backwards from early documents of the colonists to infer the routes and topography of the region prior to white settlement. Imagine these sandhills and cedar hill all pine-topped. Imagine peat bogs in the low-lying bowls between the hills. Imagine Mill Street as the main route of ingress to Block 2, Waterloo Township, in the 1800s, following a Haudenosaunee trail all the way south to Dundas at the head of the Lake Ontario. The Haudenosaunee and the Anishinaabe liked the creek and bog waters here on the west side of the Grand, and so too did the colonists. Joseph Schneider's mill needed the creek, after all. The Lang Tannery and Bright Hop Leather Companies needed the peat bogs. The problem wasn't the water. The problem was the waste. What to do with it all? By the 1850s and 60s, just up the hill above Schneider Creek, the Industrial Revolution was swinging into inland Canada West. Soon, numerous industries and breweries, a glue factory, slaughterhouses, and gasworks dotted the outer rim of the town's royal king-queen intersection. And the effluent flowing down through Schneider Creek became not just unbearable for the several thousand residents to smell, but was entirely unsanitary. For decades, according to Elizabeth Bloomfield's Waterloo Township through two centuries, Berlin faced annual epidemics of diphtheria and scarlet fever and typhoid too. It got so bad that the township threatened legal proceedings against its main city if it didn't build a proper sewer. So in 1891, Berlin installed a 20-acre sewer farm down Mill Street, the beginning of our now 130-year-old effort at containing and managing the flow of our city's waste and stormwater runoff. But the problems didn't go away. For example, a farmer on Mill Street named Ephraim Weber successfully sued Berlin in 1901 for more than $2,800 in damages. His cattle had become contaminated with anthrax from the untreated tannery wastes coursing through Schneider Creek. These 200 years of rapid changes to the creek have certainly been dramatic, but the industrial boom of the 19th century is not uniquely responsible. Instead, it's really the post-war acceleration and urban sprawl in my grandparents' lifetimes that has had the greatest compounding effects. In 2017, two University of Guelph environmental engineers set out to study the effect of urbanization on the composition of the creek. Comparing aerial photographs from 1946 and 2016, they quantify the fact that over the last 80 years, our region has entirely transformed from largely agricultural land use, so 78% agricultural and 9% urban in 1940, to heavily urbanized land use, 7% agricultural now, and 74% urban in 2016. For Schneider Creek, this entire flip in land use has meant that a river once dominated by natural meandering patterns is now largely controlled by river engineering and channelization measures. As a result, 80.1% of the creek is now channelized. Meandering creeks needed too much land to move about, the thinking went. Far better to prevent channel migrations or embankment erosion with the durability of concrete. And better to direct the water south and away in fast, linear flow. As such, Schneider Creek is now nearly 1,500 meters shorter than it was in 1946. The creek, in other words, is not just squeezed, it's been cut short.
Oh, that's depressing.
Well, that's just station two.
That's just station two. Okay.
So let me take you on a walk.
That's very fascinating. I really like that history lesson.
Thank you. So, and part of what I'm trying to do is build up each of these different seven stations will speak to each other in small ways. So some of this history will weave back in. But what I'm interested in is also getting to the fact that the city of Kitchener has just finished an environmental assessment and approved a two-phase renaturalization of two sections of this creek.
That's great.
Which is really fascinating and exciting, I think.
Yes.
So that comes up in Station 4 a little
okay,
bit.
Okay, great.
So Station 4, you've come down Mill Street across from Schneider House. There was a Station 3 was right at the Benton Street pedestrian bridge. And then you follow the creek a bit more and there's Peter Street pedestrian bridge. And that's right where his Iron Horse Trail meets. And you cross Mill Street to get to the park. So here is Station 4, Slow Water. With so much of the city's land area now paved in asphalt, poured in concrete, or roofed over with shingles, all of it slanting rain to the street's stormwater drains, recent flood mapping projects that Schneider Creek could spill its banks in a major storm, threatening lives and flooding out homes and businesses. In early 2023, a mailer at my door announced the city's plan to assess the viability of renaturalizing the confluence of Shoemaker and Schneider Creeks. The project would run south of the Sterling and Cortland intersection all the way to Sydney Street at Rockway Golf Course. But before the design work could begin, the city was undertaking an environmental assessment of the creek and doing community outreach to learn what residents want. At the first community meeting in April 2023, some residents responded with alarm that the concrete embankments and creek bed might be removed. "Well, someone put it there for a reason," a woman exclaimed from the middle table at the old clubhouse at Rockway Golf Course. She has a point. Concrete is one irrefutable marker of modernity, a poured symbol of human ingenuity and power. Anthropologists Christiane Simonetti and Tim Ingold argue that concrete's suffocating surfaces help to create a sense of lasting control over nature. And water, after water, concrete is the most used substance in the world. Via the construction of dumps and skyscrapers and transoceanic canals, concrete has allowed us to distance ourselves from our rural origins, to, quote, transcend boundaries, defy gravity, and globalize the world. We've grown confident in its near miraculous, solid, fluid form. Our gray infrastructure, as urban planners phrase it, seems artificial, impermeable, utterly durable. And in turn, concrete has taught us to expect the feel of solidity beneath our feet as we walk our built environments. Or put that another way, concrete has unlearned us the feel of the land beneath our feet. Simonetti and Ingold point out that concrete is in fact more unstable than we think. Just like other geologic rock formations, as well as trees and people, concrete is in a state of constant becoming. The whole earth entire is in flux. They write, "Only continuing practices of care can sustain the impression of concrete's permanence." The language of care here is striking to me. If concrete needs such care to upkeep its suffocating durability, why not channel our care towards sustaining a more biodiverse creek system instead? And that is, in fact, precisely the turn we're living through, a literal sea change in approaches to water management the entire world over. Urban planners and citizen activists are urging governments and landowners to devise better, more natural ways of managing water. So Tibbetts Brook in the Bronx, for instance, was buried in 1912 but is now being daylighted, its tunneled waters restored to sunlight and the loose hug of earthen embankment. San Francisco Bay is the site of the biggest tidal wetland restoration project in the world. The city of Seoul famously disassembled an expressway and daylighted the Cheonggyecheon stream 20 years ago, and the restoration effort has brought compounding benefits to the neighborhood and city. All throughout China, President Xi Jinping's massive Sponge Cities program is restoring urban floodplains and parks and wetlands in a Herculean effort at managing the sheer volume of water expected to fall from the skies in the coming decades. Seemingly everywhere, cities are busting apart some of that aging gray infrastructure. People are trying to give water room to breathe again. These efforts go by various names: nature-based systems, green or natural infrastructure, water-sensitive urban design. But altogether, Victoria-based journalist Erica Gies groups them as the Slow Water Movement. In her globe-spanning and surprisingly hopeful book, Water Always Wins, Thriving in an Age of Drought and Deluge, she asks the important question, what does water want? And what water wants, she finds, is to move more slowly. Gies notes that from an aesthetic perspective, the trouble with nature-based systems designs is that nature tends to be messy. If we commit to renaturalizing our urban creeks and riverways, we'll also need to accept periodic inundation and muddy exposure. Plants that live and die. Widespread acceptance of slow water, she writes, will require an attitude adjustment to the way we think about this vital compound, from commodity or industrial input to partner, friend, relative, life.
That was great. Thank you. So beautiful. You have a website to share with the audience?
Sure. Yeah. So thecreekcollective.com. Perfect. Is where it has an events page and a projects page. We also have a creek diary. So we're inviting people to take photos and interact with Schneider Creek, mm-hmm. and then upload their postings there.
Yeah.
And then awesome. My own website is Jeff with a G, G-E-O-F-F, -martin.com.
Excellent. Check them out, guys. This is so beautiful. Much. Thank you.
Thank you.
A warm welcome to our second guest reader, Chantal Powell. Chantal is a Kitchener-based speculative fiction writer and artist. Chantal's writing has been published in numerous magazines, and upcoming publications are listed on Chantal's blog, I believe. Is that right?
Yes, I have them on my Dreamwidth page.
Awesome. So what does success look like to you?
Oh my gosh, how about I win the Pulitzer?
That's good.
Go big or go home, huh?
Yes, I agree. Have you ever Googled yourself?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I started doing web design back in 1995 when the internet was a tiny place. So,
wow.
Yeah.
How does that look? You must have seen a lot of changes, right?
Oh, yeah. I used to be a big shot on the internet. Back before they had anything called influencers, I called myself a celebrity.
Nice. What is your writing kryptonite?
My writing kryptonite? Probably migraines.
Oh, no. That's a... Yeah. Yeah. Oh, so you suffer from migraines and then you just can't focus.
Yeah. If I can't see and I can't think, it's kind of hard to write.
I agree. All right. So you can begin when you're ready. Let us know what you're going to read.
Sure thing. I'm going to be reading you a story called The Snow Hath No Queen, which is my retelling of Hans Christian Andersen's The Snow Queen, but doing it a little bit dystopian style. Chimney County has a good waste disposal system, but we must all do our part to keep the streets clean. Sunflakes melt tires into treacle, and if they're allowed to bank up, they catch the air on fire. Wailing sirens send us back to our homes where we must seal the entryways. Even the filtered air stinks of burning petrochemicals on those days. I live in Smokestack 32A on Chimney Sweep Street in Chimney County. I close the sunroof when Hyperion sails by overhead and his team's hooves tear up the cobblestones of the sky to send sunflakes raining down. Once Hyperion reaches the west, I don my asbestos suit and go out into the heat-haze streets to shovel the driveway. I dump the sunflakes into insulated dustbins and not onto the street because I am a good citizen. And at night, when the heat isn't quite as fierce, I dream of snow. No one has ever seen such a thing. It's a fairy tale creation, like unicorns or lions. And in my dreams, there are no sunflakes, no asbestos suits, and no heat sirens. Instead of glowing with molten plastics, the world is white and flecked with synthetic diamond sparkles. I'm not covered in soot and sweat. Instead, my skin shrinks against my flesh and my silver exhalations off-gas into the sky. Is this what cold feels like? When I imagine hard enough, little bumps rise upon my skin and reach out to kiss the air. My teeth clack against one another like pistons, and my knees knock in the dance of freezing. In my dreams, I slide out across a solid river, gliding with ease until I fall through a hole in the ice. That's what it's called, ice. And I'm submerged in water so cold it burns my skin like sunflakes. I wear my panic sluggishly. My heart slows. My movements slow, and soon I'm breathing water. Not effectively. Not at all. And when I die, my spirit erupts somewhere far from Hyperion's reach. I never knew all the codfish went to the underworld when the Grand Banks collapsed. When my ancient ancestors first came from the eastern continents, the cod were so plentiful that you could hop your way across the ocean on their backs. This was back before there was plastic. My ancestors staked claims on land and sea alike. They killed the cod like they killed the great herds of bison and the sun-blocking flocks of passenger pigeons, only they used trawling nets instead of guns. I wonder if I'll see bison and pigeons down here, too. I know one thing. One of these chthonic codfish has a map tattooed on its skin. I do not know how to find this singular fish in the sea of the underworld. In my death dream, my spirit corpse swims with the fishes, wriggling with the currents and swirling through schools of aluminum-colored fish. The shoal coalesces into the shape of a huge maw. It opens, big enough to swallow the world in a single gulp, and I wake from death to escape. When I open my eyes, I'm in my air-filtered sleep tent, clasping a tommy cod. Its mouth opens and closes with metronome regularity. Its gills flare and recede as it flops in my hands. It's drowning in air. I carry it to the kitchenette and dispatch it with a knife. When I peel the skin away, I find my map tattooed on the underside. This map is from a forgotten era. It's like looking at a subway map from antiquity. I see land masses where there should be none, and are those continents? You are here is marked in the middle of one of several oceans. It's marked atop Chimney County, right in the middle of the Great Pacific Garbage Patch. The garbage patch looks right, but the other geography makes no sense. The Earth flooded those land masses away years ago when the glaciers melted and the polar ice caps disintegrated. Nowadays, land is made from salvaged plastic, floating in interlocked masses atop a dead and stinking sea. There might not be land like in olden times, but there's more than enough plastic to create a reasonable facsimile. As I trace my fingers along the contours of the map, I'm transported to a place with neither sunflakes nor snowflakes. A vast field is polka-dotted with all the wrong colors. Instead of sepia, the sky is blue, and the earth is green instead of gray and black. And I see and smell blossoms of red, violet, yellow, and pink. Where are all the microplastics? Where's the smoke? My nose doesn't know what to do with this lack of scent, so I sneeze. And then I hear a drone of sound as little yellow and black creatures land on the blossoms. Bees, I think. These must be bees. I thought they were mythological. I lie down amongst living flowers and a vine creeps its way toward me, tendrilling down into my ears and whispering to me about the queen of snow. When flowers whisper, they sound like the cold things of my dreams, like sleet in relentless wind, The frigid wash of white noise lulls me to sleep, and I awaken on the green field, now twinkling with hoarfrost, blossoms locked into place behind a thin filigree of ice. A huge white caribou erupts into the frosty soil right in front of me. She gazes at me with red eyes and lowers her head, then bows down onto her front knees. Her name is Tuktu. I know this, though I don't know why. I get on her back and her muscles bunch, then relax as she stands back up, and then we're tearing across the sky like Hyperion, like Santa, like the archaeological ISS space mark. We gallop across the aurora, a green and red drift of light painting the evening in a coat so thick the stars and satellites don't shine through. The northern lights shift, but Tuktu doesn't lose her footing. She's migrated across the sky all her life. We pass over taiga, muskeg, and tundra, rocks encrusted with lichen, massive floating icebergs, and sheets of ice reaching out across the Arctic Sea. We pass through a conspiracy of ravens, croaking and cawing as they wheel through the air. We travel for hours through sunless sky until we find a campsite with glowing ice mounds spread across the tundra. Tuktu will not enter the camp, so I slide off her back. She snorts, then leaps back up into the sky and gallops off. A massive igloo rises like a mountain before me. I pass sleeping dogs, their noses tucked beneath their tails, and crawl through the entrance. Inside is a lake, light flickering far below the frozen translucent surface. That's fire down there, the only familiar thing I've seen on this journey. I walk across the ice in my bare feet, reach inside my coat pocket and pull out a handful of sunflakes. I scatter them, and they burrow like worms through the ice, hissing as they go. A woman clad in white fur rises from the water on the back of a whale, her hair a wild black tangle of icicles. She has no fingers. Seals and walruses squeeze out from the stumps. "You have no business here, Kalanath," she says from the pinniped pile. She waves her sea-birthing hands, and like that, I'm back home. I live in Smokestack 32A on Chimney Sweep Street in Chimney County. In the daytime, I wear asbestos. When the heat is not so bad, I dream of winter and the caribou in the sky. I dream of huge schools of fish and fire burning below the ice. I dream of these things, but I'm careful not to think of the woman with no fingers. I'm a good citizen. I go outside and shovel sunflakes into the bins.
Thank you. That was awesome.
Thank you.
You have a lot of experience. I see you have a penchant for oral presentation.
Yeah, I do voiceover work and narration.
Nice. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I used to work in radio a long time ago, back around 1991, I think is when I got my start in radio.
You haven't lost a thing.
Thank you. And I used to do a lot of drama too. I've done stage productions and radio drama too.
Awesome. And where can we find your website or blog, or is it all together?
You can find me on Mastodon. I don't remember the URL because it's complicated, but you can also find my blog on DreamWidth, and that is shanmonster.com. At DreamWidth, oh my gosh, I can't even remember how to say it. I'm used to typing it, but I can't speak it.
I know the feeling.
Shanmonster.dreamwidth.org. I believe that will take you to it.
Amazing. I'll check her out, you guys. That was awesome. We'll be right back with our final reader. Stay tuned. Thank you, Chantel.
How will you ever know the way that circumstances go? Always gonna hit you by surprise. Well, I know my past, you were there, everything I've done, you are the one. Thank you.
Welcome back, folks. Finally, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Richard H. Stevens. Richard is an epic fantasy author who has written and published 14 books in his Soul Forge universe. Book 15, When Legends Rise, releases a week from today and will have its own world premiere at Hespler Legion on April 28th from 11 till 2. I know Richard would love to see you. Tell us, Richard, what are the best ways to market your books?
Hi, Jody. Thanks for having me. Being an independent author, I find Facebook's the best way to, or no, sorry, not Facebook, Amazon's the best way to market my books. And the problem with doing Amazon is you have to pay money for Amazon ads. So
right.
That's a beast that's hard to break itself. So there are some months I'll spend a lot more on my ads than I actually make. And then there are months that it goes the other way. But it's tough when you're an independent publisher, a published author. So
you have seen some success with the Amazon ads?
Yes, but it's never consistent. Right. And that's the problem. I've invested $600 one month and made $200.
That makes sense.
Yeah, you can't keep doing that.
And other times it goes the other way.
Yeah, but the returns aren't as big the other way. But
I understand.
Yeah, so probably the best way for me to market myself is going to events and doing personal book signings.
Right.
I do a lot better when I do events around Southern Ontario, mm-hmm. and especially themed events. So, yeah.
Perfect. And how long, on average, does it take you to write a book?
I can write a trilogy if every book is about 300 pages, probably in a year.
That's awesome.
Yeah, this one, this is 700 pages, and this took me about a year and a half. Life got in the way, and us.
It's a beauty.
You can't count on that. Yeah, it's 700 pages of story, and then you got to get into the editing, and that takes a long time as well. So
that's for sure.
Yeah, I've almost kicked myself when I realized how long it was. So,
I believe it. And I wanted to know, did publishing your first book change your process of writing?
Yeah, I guess it would. It did. I went to Nashville in 2017, and I pitched an agent down there, and I worked with the agent for a while, and I found that very stressful, and it wasn't getting me what I wanted. So I decided I have to do this on my own if I actually want to publish my book in the near future. So I found a professional editor, and she's in Glasgow, Scotland, and a professional cover designer in Italy at the time, and I did it from there. And in 2018, I published my first book. And I was fortunate enough that my wife allowed me to leave my full-time job so I could write full-time at that point. So,
At that point, my whole writing changed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. Well, whenever you're ready, begin. I'm excited to hear this one. I've read one of Richard's books, so I'm excited.
So this is book 4 in the Highcliffe Guardians series, and it's all about the rise of an elf queen. And in book 1, she's not an elf queen, she's a princess, but they've lost the kingdom, and this is about them trying to get the kingdom back. And the neat thing about the Highcliffe Guardians series is I challenged myself to write about a goblin. So if you're into fantasy, you know what a goblin is, and I wanted to make my goblin different. So I made my goblin the High Wizard of the Elves, and of course the elves don't like that. But this is just a scene out of there where this High Wizard also has an elven apprentice, and something's happening in the story, and I'll just jump right into it.
Perfect.
And this chapter's called Wizard at Large, and there's four main characters. Scale is an elven, he's the elven apprentice, he's kind of a bumbling apprentice. Elfwyn is the High Wizard, he's the goblin, and the Odling Wise is the deposed queen of the elves. She doesn't have a kingdom anymore that they're trying to get it back for her. So, and then there's Balewind, and she is an elf guardian. She's the one who looks after the High Wizard so that no one can cause harm to him. But so Scale didn't know what he had done this time. Whatever it was, it must have been catastrophic in High Wizard Elfin's estimation. The old goblin's lair high atop the loftiest tower of the Fortress of Kay's Revenge was packed with elves, goblins, and dwarves who looked at him sideways as he entered, most of whom would never voluntarily be caught within the confines of the mystical chamber. Still bleary from yesterday's celebrations, Scale ignored their stares and stumbled across the threshold into the octagonal chamber, the room larger than the one he had shared with Elfwyn back at Highcliffe. He caught Eolan's eye from across the floor, but the old caretaker neither smiled nor frowned back at him. Instead, the goblin dipped his chin, as if greeting some lesser vassal. Worried that perhaps he should not have come, Scale couldn't help thinking it didn't bode well that Balewyn had been charged to escort him. especially since Elfin had an entire castle full of pages and squires to do his bidding. To make matters worse, the considerable din of conversation fell off, as if severed by a headsman's axe, when Beowyn stepped into the chamber behind him and closed the door. Scale would have left right then, but Beowyn's firm push from behind kept his feet moving toward the far end of the lair, where a surly goblin leaned on a length of gnarled wood, the staff etched with effigies of hideous faces that appeared in varying stages of death. On Elfin's right stood Queen Odaling and King Pecklin, the elven monarch's stoic faces hinting that whatever was about to occur, it would be momentous. Prince Breen and Queen Cassava stood solemnly on Elfin's left. The prince offered him a subtle wink. That solitary gesture, the only thing that prevented Scale's shaking legs from collapsing underneath him. Prodded by the stalwart Beowyn, Scale approached the High Wizard of South March with hands folded at his waist, his eyes lowered. Thankfully, Beowyn had the presence of mind to tug on the back of his tunic to prevent him from stumbling headlong into the one creature beside Beowyn who possessed the uncanny ability to terrify him for no reason. In the time since his role in Princess Odaling's escort to Highcliff, he had battled Grimgard, fought to the death with a pack of Chazgul, been in the presence of enraged dragons, dealt with angry wizards dispensing devastating spells, and even had a maniacal castle try to bury him alive. But never would he feel at ease in the presence of the diminutive High Wizard or that of the no-nonsense guardian. He would rather go back and face the flesh-eating Chazgul. Elfin, being who he was not afraid to let his short temper run its course, no matter whose company he kept.
"Scale, what?"
Elfin said in an unexpected calm voice.
"What do you have to say for yourself?"
Scale felt tongue-tied. Elfin's calm demeanor did not bode well. He had no idea what the goblin was talking about, but the eeriness of the High Wizard's tone affirmed that this was not going to be an ordinary encounter.
I have nothing to say, Master.
"Of all days to find yourself speechless, you choose the time of your ascension to hold your tongue? Ironic,"
Elfin declared, and stamped the Staff of Reckoning on the flagstone floor, the disgusting faces twisting of their own accord as the greenish hue shrouded the length of wood.
"So be it."
Scale might have turned and bolted, if not for the resolute guardian at his back. Trapped between Elfin and Beowyn, he fretted that he might soil himself, an act that wouldn't be viewed highly by the two he feared most. It was all he could do not to squeak when Elfin raised his voice.
"I've called this gathering to commemorate a special day, one in which my apprentice learns of his forthcoming appointment to the lofty position of wizard at large. A proclamation I do not bestow upon the son of Charentwood lightly."
If not for Beowyn's firm grip on his sword belt, Scale's legs would have failed him. As it was, all he could do was gape. The absolute silence in the chamber thundered in his head. It was so quiet, he imagined he could hear the silent screams emitted by the souls trapped within Elfin staff. Beowyn leaned in to whisper harshly,
"Get a hold of yourself and say something before he changes his mind."
Scale nodded and swallowed, dropping to a knee, his route to the ground impeded by Beowyn, who must have thought he was falling. He bowed his head.
I don't know what to say, Master Elfin. I'm humbled.
Elfin shook his head in dismay. "You can start by standing up again. I'm no king, you bigaloo."
He indicated Queen Odaling with the tip of his head.
"You kneel to queens, not wizards. Any imbecile knows that. Perhaps your ascension is premature."
Scale jumped to his feet.
No, Master. You're not royalty. It's just that... I never expected such an honor."
"I imagine not,"
Elfin growled and turned to speak to Queen Odaling.
"I never expected it either."
Her pale skin cast in the greenish glow of the Staff of Reckoning, Odaling laughed, the gesture breaking the hush that had taken hold of the chamber.
"Scale has his moments, Master Elfin, but don't we all?" Odaling said quietly, before she threw back her shoulders and spoke so that everyone in the wizard's lair could hear.
"As Queen of the Elves, I hereby acknowledge that Scale Wood, acolyte of High Wizard Elfin, should, from this day forth, be known as Wizard at Large." Elfin held up a claw-tipped finger.
"I beg your forgiveness, Your Grace. There's one more thing required of Scale before he officially acquires this auspicious title."
Odaling frowned. "Of course, Master Elfin. Pray tell us what that might be." Elfin bowed his head in respect to his liege before addressing Scale, the glow of his staff increasing to encompass the wider area.
Scalewood won't earn the title until he embarks upon and successfully completes a most important quest, a quest that only he is capable of undertaking.
Before Scale had the wherewithal to think better of it, he blurted, "Of course, Master Elfin, whatever you require of me shall be done." An evil smile twisted the High Wizard's large mouth, exposing pointed yellow teeth.
"You must return to the castle you discovered that fateful day you triggered the summoning spell."
Scale nodded enthusiastically, but as the crux of what Elfin suggested sunk in, a cold spike of apprehension caused him to stutter, Of course, Master, whatever you say, it will be done." Elfin's rasping voice almost sounded vindictive.
"Do not fail me in this."
Master Elfin wasn't asking him to simply summon the dragon's reign to another part of the world and come back. The High Wizard expected him to return to a castle embodied by an evil presence, a castle that had crumbled to the ground around him in an attempt to kill him, to revisit the place inhabited by a ghostly fog that had threatened to pull him and Zeraine out of the sky. He gulped.
"No, Master. I'll try not to."
Elfin's eyes narrowed to mere slits. He thumped the Staff of Reckoning on the ground, and the faces went still. The many sconces in around the room flickered and went out, dropping the chamber into darkness, all except for the subtle glow fading from his staff.
"That's good to hear you say that, because the Queen's life will be in your hands."
Awesome. Thank you, Richard. You have a gift, that's for sure.
Thank you.
I know you have lots of experience. I always enjoy listening to you read.
So thank you.
Tell us a little bit more about your launch.
So the launch is happening, like you say, in Hesper at the Hefler Legion on next Sunday. And When Legends Rise, we've been making its worldwide debut. It's a 700-page book. It's the fourth book in the High Cliff Guardian series. It's the last book in that series. So I generally write in trilogies, but this is about the rise of Queen Odaling. And it's taken so many more pages to write her story. So High Cliff Guardians book one was 600 pages. I generally write 300 to 400 pages. And every book since then has been 600 to 700 pages.
Oh, wow. And you're going to have the first three books in case somebody's
absolutely
new to
all
writing.
And I'm going to have special limited edition character cards as well that come from the series. So that if people actually, to encourage people to buy all four books, the Tetralogy.
Of course.
Yeah, so that's just another marketing ploy to try and get them to buy all books at once. Because generally, if you're new to me, you know, you might take a chance on one book.
Right.
But it's nice to sell four books. And,
yes,
of course, they'll all be signed and I'll personalize them to you.
That's the best.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's the best. Thank you. I enjoyed that.
No, thank you.
And where else can we find your books other than Amazon? You have a website?
Yeah, my books are on Amazon, of course. And they're also on my website at www.richardhstevens.com. And Stevens is spelled with a P-H, so it's S-T-E-P-H-E-N-S. And just go on there. You can get a hold of me. My email is there as well. And I ship them worldwide. I've shipped them to New Zealand. If you're willing to pay the postage, I'm willing to ship them. But,
awesome.
Yeah, that's the problem of being a Canadian author is Canada Post is so expensive.
But, it is, yeah. I know.
But that's just the cost of doing business. So
great. Thank you so much.
No, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. All right. We'll be right back.
Should have known by the tone of my voice, maybe, but you didn't listen. You played dead, but you never played. Instead, you laid still in the grass, or coiled up in the sand. And though I know all about those men,
Welcome back, folks. I just had a couple coming events that I wanted to let you know about. If you want to get together and work on your writing projects, you can join the write-in at Cafe 1842 Mondays from 7 to 9 p.m. at 59 King Street North in Waterloo. And I'm excited to say that Book Fest is back. That'll be Saturday, May 25th from 2 to 8 p.m. at the Waterloo Public Square, 75 King Street South in Waterloo. This is a KW Writers Alliance outdoor book fair, and it features dozens of local authors. I'll be there, and some of the other guests that have been on the show will also be there. So you can come visit us, check us out, get some book swag. It'll be fun. Once more, I'd like to thank our three authors for coming into the studio and fascinating us with their readings. You can hear the whole program on CKMS 102.7 FM Radio Waterloo website if you've missed anything or want to listen to this episode again. And please subscribe to our YouTube channel at Reader's Delight KW, and you'll be able to see the video of the show. Reader's Delight will air every 4 weeks, so don't forget to tune in on Sunday, May 19th from 1 to 2 p.m. for a brand new episode. Until then, thanks for listening. I'm your host, Jody Swinnell.
You This is CK.